Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Today's episode could not have had better timing, considering Elon's highly controversial appearance at the DealBook conference earlier this week, where he literally said F you to the advertisers that are strangling the company's business. I thought it'd be great to post this episode with Ben Mezrich. He's the author of Breaking Twitter, Elon Musk, and the Most Controversial Corporate Takeover in History. Ben has written a bunch of books that I know people have checked out. And crucially, for the purposes of this conversation, he wrote the book, The Accidental Billionaires, that turned into The Social Network, one of my favorite movies. In this conversation, we discuss everything from the origin of the Twitter acquisition, what's gone right, what's gone wrong, and the challenges moving forward, challenges that are no doubt going to escalate as the advertiser crisis and controversy continues. Hope you all enjoy the conversation. Ben Mezrich, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you so much for having me.
A lot of listeners, aside from just your recent movies and books, will recall The Accidental Billionaires as probably being the foundational Ben Mezrich tech book in this space, like the history of Facebook. So as I was reading Breaking Twitter, I like to think of these two books as almost bookending the social media era and the moment. How in some way, so much of what's going wrong and right, in the best sense of the term, during the Elon acquisition is an attempt to recapture the spirit of 2005 to 2009. I'm curious about how you would respond to that interpretation of what's really going on in everyone's head as this is going down.
I mean, I think that's a really interesting way to look at it. You know, you have Accidental Billionaires, which became The Social Network, telling the story of where it all started with this kind of dream of us all moving online to this global village that we'd all be a part of. But you have to remember there was, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, who somewhat megalomaniacally wanted everyone to be in a world that he was king of. So you do have parallels. Then you have Breaking Twitter, which is a much darker story, I guess, of when things get out of control. I mean, in my reading or my view of what's happened at Twitter now X, is that you had Elon come in with good intentions, at least in his own mind, of sort of saving the world from a woke mind virus, as he called it, of somehow freedom of speech rising out, you know, of this morass, when in reality it spiraled down to the worst place that the internet can go. So you do see this as sort of a beginning that's all full of optimism, and then a place now where we're at, where it seems like not many people can be very optimistic about the direction social media is going. So I think that's a great way to look at it.
I'd love to hear from you how Elon would articulate Twitter as being the source of the woke mind virus. Because as a person who actually does most of his work in the political space, I would actually argue that the wokest parts of, let's say, the Democratic Party that he's unhappy with have the most power on Twitter. And anything, Joe Biden's ability to not make decisions that would make Elon unhappy stem from the fact that he is just not on Twitter. So I'd love for you to kind of unpack the theory of the, because he really believes this. This is why, I'm not saying this sarcastically. Could you explain what's the theory of the case here?
Yeah. So what he was seeing happening when he kind of came up with this whole concept, and let's roll back one instant. He believes that we're in this window of time, this moment of time where man can become interplanetary. He believes this is the most important thing because it's going to save us from some catastrophe. And he's the man that's going to get us there. And he sees Twitter as being a place where the global conversation takes place. And if freedom of speech goes away, then the window will close and we'll end up back in the dark ages and we'll never get to Mars. It's a kind of a crazy theory. You have to put it all together step by step, but that's what he believes. So what he means by the woke mind virus is, first of all, he believed that Twitter was moderating anything outside of the mainstream. And it came to a head over a tweet by the Babylon Bee, you know, the comedic Twitter business, basically, making fun of the trans Department of Health guy, girl, sorry, I don't want to get in trouble. And it was a tweet that affected Elon personally. I mean, if you read the Walter Isaacson's book, he's got a child who went trans, and it turned into a battle between him and the child a little bit. But also, he believed that them limiting this free speech comic joke or whatever was a signal, a symptom, and that they were limiting other voices like the New York Post talking about Hunter Biden. A lot of conservative voices felt like they were being limited. But it was bigger than that. It was this cultural move to a world where things he disagreed with were happening. I don't want to get, you know, I don't want to be too accusatory, but I think that, you know, the conservative view of the liberalization of Twitter was going on, that there was this kind of move to a place where they were banning anti-COVID stuff. Anything that didn't seem out of the mainstream about COVID was getting banned. Anything about Hunter Biden was getting banned. Any joke about trans was getting banned. And he thought that was this sort of stifling of free speech. So that's what he meant by that.
And I think you just articulated the central issue here. Every single thing you just articulated can be true. I think it is true to a certain degree. But that has almost nothing to do with the business challenges facing Twitter. And in trying to solve the problems you just articulated, you actually can make the business case for Twitter even, you can make it even worse in the first place. So can you really articulate the difference between the political, sociological problems and just the fact that for whatever reason, Twitter has never been able to make a very good going of it in comparison to, let's say, Facebook, TikTok, right, these other social media apps?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, and I don't want there to rewrite history in saying that Twitter was on its way to bankruptcy, because I know that's what Elon likes to say a lot now. I don't believe that was true at all. I mean, Twitter was very close to break even, if not at break even. It wasn't making a ton of money. It wasn't becoming Facebook, but it was doing okay financially because of advertising. You know, 90% of its revenue came through advertising. Being heavy-handed at moderating is not something advertisers dislike. You know, for the most part, advertisers would be happy for you to moderate as much as you can, because they just don't want to have their ads next to something that pisses somebody off. So they don't really care. You know, a lot of people say advertisers maybe are liberal. I don't think that's true. I think they're just against anything that upsets people. So, you know, they pull ads from something that was, you know, crazy liberal too. They don't want crazy. they want something middle of the road. So, you know, I absolutely, Elon would say he did not come into this to make money. It wasn't about turning Twitter into a massively profitable business, although that's what it became because he had all these bankers that invested in it. And suddenly it losing money looks really bad and is getting worse and worse and worse. But I don't think he came in for that reason. I say he came in for noble reasons in his mind, to save the world. So it wasn't about how do I make Twitter more profitable. He definitely thought he could make it more profitable, but it wasn't the thing. And, you know, he made a crazy offer for Twitter. You have to remember, he offered way more than it was worth, knowing that he was offering way more than it was worth. He wrote a letter along with it, which is in the book, basically saying you can't turn this offer down because this is way more than the company is worth. So it wasn't really all about money, but it quickly became about money when he chased all the advertisers away.
And the way I like to think about this and the way you tell the story, I kind of bracketed different alternate realities into the following three categories. So there's kind of Jack Dorsey, because Jack is kicked out again, but he's still kind of like in, you know, behind the scenes. Jack has this very straightforward conclusion that, look, the problem with Twitter is that it's not a protocol. It's a company. It's a corporation. It was always a mistake to take it that direction. That is fundamentally incompatible with this ideal of being a free speech style organization. So that's camp one. Camp two would be the camp that I kind of lean towards, which is like, look, ultimately, there's no advertiser who would support the idea of a truly free speech global platform. That's going to cause a lot of problems. And I'm skeptical of the desire of enough people to subscribe to support such a service. So maybe we should treat this like the Wikimedia Foundation and do the Wikipedia thing. It's a nonprofit. It's a public square, like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of like a utility. Then there's camp three, which is the Elon camp, which is no, we could get the right mix of advertising and subscription to make this a real, if not gargantuan, business. Given those three models, and correct me if you think that's not quite the right articulation of it, which do you lean towards if we're going to buy that the goal is a free speech platform where we could all have a global commons?
I mean, personally, I think that I don't like subscription personally if subscription gives you boosting of tweets and things like that, because then I think you throw off the whole idea of free speech by making it pay to play. You could have a pay-to-play site where, you know, you pay more for more exposure of your tweets and things like that. But that's not at all, giving any sort of move towards free speech or a place where ideas that are good rise to the top or truth, something like that.
I think I pause you there real quick because you just got into a fascinating issue, though. So if we think of free speech in America or the West broadly, we all have free speech, but let's say I'm a billionaire, could definitely buy a television station. So I love you to kind of like, you're getting at the balancing act.
That's problematic. I mean, I think what Elon was hoping to do was create a place where everyone's kind of treated equal, where everyone has a shot and it's ideas that rise. He wanted it to be the most true place on the internet. And ironically, it's the least true place on the internet. but I think that what I like Jack Dorsey, I think what Jack Dorsey was attempting to do was, you know, interesting, but like what you said in your second idea, which is that you can't have unfettered free speech. It's just not possible on the internet. And we've seen this over and over again. It's because, you know, there's a lot of people on the internet with really bad intentions. And also there's a lot of teenagers on the internet. I have a teenager. I can't give him free speech, right? If he was allowed to say whatever he wants, it would be ugly. And we all know that. We all know what 13 and 14 and 15 year olds are like. And, you know, there's a lot of those kids on the internet, and Twitter has to be moderated. The question is, and listen, there's nobody in the world who's truly a free speech absolutist, even Jack Dorsey. Nobody would want, say, the president of the United States to go on Twitter and say, I'm launching nuclear weapons, you know, just as a joke. Everyone would moderate that speech. Everyone has a line that they draw. It's just, where do you draw that line? And Dorsey, you know, had this vision of it being a protocol. But in practice, that was never really possible.
Can you explain what a protocol is?
Well, the protocol is like texting. It's like texting. It's like a giant text space where anybody's basically texting something and it spreads out. So there's no authority. There's nothing in the middle. You know, he's a big fan of like Bitcoin, of things where there's no middle, you know, what do you call it? Workings. It's basically a protocol. It's the way you send emails. It's the way you say, and it's an interesting idea, but it quickly becomes like 4chan. It becomes a place where you really can't go and avoid really bad stuff. So you need moderation in some, and every social media needs moderation. I think Elon wants to engineer the moderating. So his goal is, computers are doing its algorithms and as little people involved as possible, which in theory is interesting, but we're just not there with AI yet. And maybe we'll get there at some point, but someone has to write in the parameters, and free speech tends towards nasty stuff. That's just what happens if there's no adult in the room looking at it. In the past, I think Twitter over-moderated conservative voices or certain out of the mainstream voices, but it also did a pretty good job of moderating hate speech and of all of the stuff that we're seeing today. Now, X does very little moderating, and it's impossible to use the site. But worse than not moderating, it pushes those sites or those people that raise outrage, that get engagement. It's become an engagement and outrage engine. So rather than just giving it free speech, it actually has an algorithm that raises the speech that's worse. I would argue that's way worse than not moderating, is you'll see it over and over again. If you look through Twitter, the things that are getting tons of views are the worst things. And that's a real problem.
Yeah. And I'd love for you to talk about the structural side of these things. So for example, one of the changes that Elon makes, is it's now possible, if you subscribe to Twitter Blue, you can get paid for your tweets, which I think if we're just sitting in our Harvard Business School case study, like outlining like, hey, what are ways we can get to a 50% revenue subscriber rate? Well, that'd be a good example of it. But there's a failure to think structurally and think to yourself, okay, so if we're paying people to tweet, certain tweets are obviously going to do better. And this is what you were just kind of getting at. And the tweets that are going to do better are Jackson Hinkle spreading like fake video, or not the video is real, but like mislabeling Syrian Assad conflict as being in Gaza right now. And then they have to community note that. And now they're saying, okay, if you get community noted, we're going to like not pay you. But then, okay, but like, what's even a community note? Because some community notes like add more context. And like, it's not all. And then what if Jackson Hinkle changes the title to say, okay, this is Syria, but Gaza looks just like this. You're engineering yourself back into the original problem that way.
Right. I mean, I think the problem with it is that you're first of all siloing speech. So people who pay for certain speech are seeing certain speech and creating their own little echo chambers that involve around commerce. So you're siloing speech rather than having it spread all over the place. You're raising the engagement of speech to make money, And so people post outrageous things because that's what makes more money. Community notes in theory is a great idea, but it's kind of like posting a retraction on page 6 of a newspaper. The original tweet gets a ton of views, and then the community notes come in after the fact. People notice it and laugh. But the original view is the thing that spreads all of the sort of anger and turns into the sort of the engine behind it. I personally don't like the whole subscription model for something that's supposed to be about truth, because that's counter to it. And it's counter to freedom, and it's counter to all the things that he came in trying to do. But he only has to do it because he chased all the advertisers away. I don't think he came in, you know, he always played with the idea of subscription, but now it's a necessity, because there's no other way for Twitter to make money. And for creators to make money off the site is nice, because now we're trying to compete with YouTube, but it's shifting away from it being a global town hall. I feel like Twitter was something special. It was a place for conversation. It wasn't trying to be YouTube. It wasn't trying to be WhatsApp. It wasn't trying to be a dating website, which is what he's talking about now, or a commerce site. It was its own thing. And that's the thing that Elon went in to save. And now he's jettisoning it. It's becoming a something else, the Everything app, which is an interesting idea, but I don't think it's Twitter anymore, or it's certainly trending away from what Twitter was. He broke it. He 100% broke it. And my, you know, book is, he didn't just break Twitter, but Twitter broke him, because I don't think he meant to do this. And in doing it, it's caused him to spiral down as well.
You know, and this is where we can say this is a dark and a sad and a somewhat tragic book, is here's my interpretation. I've done a bunch of episodes on like Elon and SpaceX. So like the most positive, like if you need the bull case for Elon, it's in those categories. Ashley Vance has his great bio, all those different categories. People know about those. I would say the tragedy here is that for the first time in Elon's life, the kind of boring, you know, non-technical bureaucrat type people, I very much identify as one of these people, are directionally correct. So by contrast, like think of SpaceX, right? Like there's some Air Force guy or some person who works for Boeing or Lockheed Martin saying, no, Elon, you have to do things the way that we've done them. And guess what? Like, yes, Elon has to, you know, go through some iterations, but he's actually more than directionally correct. And those lame bureaucrat people are just completely incorrect. And Elon is now the richest person on earth because he proves them wrong. In this case, the lame, boring bureaucrat people are directionally correct. And I'm not sure Elon was ready for an environment where his instinct to override them was basically wrong. Like, what do you think about that?
Yeah, you're 100% right in that the world of SpaceX and the world of Tesla, him being sort of this rebel, taking on kind of these boring bureaucrats, as you put it, it was right, because you could fix the problem by being smart, and you could fix the problem by being a great engineer, or you could come up with a better solution through science and stuff like that. But when you get into the world of social media, the problem is you can't engineer the problems away. And being a rebel in social media tends to bring you in the wrong direction, not the right direction. And I think you're right in that for the first time in his entire career and the first time in his personal life, he is getting massive pushback and actual hate. I mean, he goes on stage with Chappelle in the story, and gets booed on stage. And it's the first time in his life he's been booed. And you think about a few months earlier, he's on Saturday Night Live, hosting Saturday Night Live.
Not a friendly audience necessarily. And he's doing well there.
Exactly. And now it's like hatred because of the decisions he's making at Twitter. So he's making wrong decision after wrong decision. And, you know, he says, oh, I'm going to make a lot of wrong decisions. But I don't think he truly expected all of his decisions to be wrong. And I think he's getting such pushback from everyone. I mean, the Tesla faithful are pushing back and yelling at him because he looks like he's moving away from Tesla. He's got to sell Tesla stock. He's hurting the Tesla price by the crazy stuff he's doing at Twitter. He's just getting roundly disliked by a large portion of the population, and he's destroyed his reputation, which today I believe his reputation is destroyed. I mean, fully half the country dislikes Elon now. And this is a guy a year ago who could do no wrong. I mean, he was the Edison of our times a year ago. And now he's a guy that most of the country derides as being, you know, wrong. And maybe, you know, whatever people, every interview I do, people are like, do you really think he's racist? Do you think he's Donald Trump? Do you think this and that? These are conversations you would never have had a year ago about Elon Musk. And so I think that he did massive damage to himself here.
Twitter, if we're going to think about it, is almost certainly the major company that folks have the most experience with, that's gone through the most, this CEO and then that CEO and then this CEO. Within the story that you're kind of telling, I'll also bracket these different style of CEOs into three categories. So category one would be Jack, which is basically the tech philosopher prince. Right. I love the way you tell these stories, because like obviously it's narrative nonfiction. So you really put me in the mind of the PM who's trying to have a serious conversation with Jack, and he's kind of responding with like unhelpful Yoda adjacent thought about, you know, it's Yoda / Buddhism adjacent thought. That's the philosopher print CEO. The next model is the Parag model, which is like the engineer. He's not like made for television. He's not like Eric out there gland handing, going on the All In podcast. Like he's just there because he codes and like that's his deal. And then you have Elon, to your writing, describes himself as like the only product manager at Twitter, but he's also just a power user. He's a CEO who's like, I'm going to fix this broken thing because I spend easily 30% of my day obsessively using, and then spend way more of his day thinking about it. So of those three models, what do you think about them? And what was your takeaway from just writing about them?
Right. Well, I really like Jack Dorsey, and I would love to see Elon hand Twitter back to Jack Dorsey. I think Dorsey is not necessarily the best manager of people, because he really is like a Yoda character. He's into the philosophy of it. I mean, he, you know, when questions are going down about whether they should moderate the New York Post about Hunter Biden, I mean, he's off in like, I don't know, Fiji or wherever. I forget where he is. I mean, he's not literally the hands-on guy that you necessarily need all the time. But he's got a really good heart and belief in what Twitter should be that makes you really like him. I have always liked Dorsey. And you look at Parag, and Parag was put into place because he wasn't flashy and because he wasn't Dorsey, and he wasn't going to steal the limelight. He wasn't going to say something stupid. And he was supposed to just be an engineer who suddenly became the head of the company who's going to. He never really had a chance to do very much. So we have no idea how he would have run the company. Honestly, he came and went so fast. But then you have Elon, and Elon is the wrong person to run Twitter for a lot of reasons. First of all, he's a power user, so he knows the site really, really well, but he really loves drama and he loves entertainment, and he wants to push the site in lots of different directions, and he doesn't want to stop tweeting, you know, the stuff that he tweets. When he becomes the head of Twitter with such a huge following, that his tweets and who he likes and who he retweets, that becomes the face of Twitter. It's not just him, but it's the people that he pushes. The algorithm then pushes, and suddenly all the top people on Twitter are you know, whatever Elon has decided that they're going to be, and that's problematic. He's also really bad for the business of Twitter, because he will not, you know, make the site a happy place for advertisers. He'll make it worse and worse and worse with his own behavior, and then he's just not stable. I mean, I think he himself would admit that he's not stable in certain ways, and that instability, it can work when you're sort of building a startup and you've got to, you know, blow away the room with this and that, but it really doesn't work in the day-to-day of running a site like this. And, you know, he came in angry. That's the other part of the story. He reluctantly took over the company because he had made that offer for the company and then realized he was paying too much, realized that it was full of bots, tried to get out of it, and was sued and forced to take over the company. And he came in wanting to burn it to the ground, to fire everyone for cause, so we didn't have to pay them bonuses. I mean, he cut the company down to a tiny core of people to the point where things weren't working properly. And then he did things that continued to upset everybody because he was angry and lashing out. And there's a lot of emotional stuff going on in this story that don't help. So I don't think you want any one of them managing Twitter, but I would love to see a Dorsey, you know, coming back and trying to make it what it was supposed to be.
But this is where, and I want folks who haven't read the book obviously yet to understand your perspective on this, because I think you are incredibly fair in this narrative. So obviously we're doing a bit of Elon dunking here, but you're very critical of the Jack Dorsey Twitter.
Yeah, old Twitter.
The bloat. The lack of focus. I love the like 2010s, like everyone's worried about the foosball tables and not the actual, like, are we shipping product? I guess the real question here is, how bad did things get in terms of late stage Twitter 1.0? Because the kind of motif you have is there's Twitter 2.0, that's Elon, there's Twitter 1.0. How bad were things prior to acquisition?
I mean, Twitter 1.0 was an incredibly bloated company with 7,500 employees. You know, in the book I described, people were more upset about the smoothie bar getting taken away than about anything involving Twitter itself. And people were working from home, and that's fine, but people were just taking 3 days off, 4 days off. I mean, it had a culture of not working, and getting something done was really, really hard. Of the people I talked to, the people who really liked it and were there were thinking of leaving because they couldn't get anything done there anymore. You know, financially, the whole economy was in a difficult spot. And one of the things that's reported in the book that hasn't really been widely reported was Parag was about to fire a large amount of employees. Maybe half the employees were on their way out. And he was already building lists of people that were going to get, there was going to be a mass firing even before Elon walked into the door. And the moderation issue, I mean, I completely agree that there was a heavy-handed moderation going on. And I think most people at Twitter agreed too. And they really were trying to make the site good, but there were times when, you know, the instincts were wrong. And I do think it was foolish to moderate the New York Post for putting an article about Hunter Biden's laptop. I think you could argue both ways about some of the suspensions that they did. But there was a feeling that it was getting heavy-handed. But on the other hand, they were really trying to keep down hate speech and things like that, which seems to have gone out the window. And then, you know, overall, I think that the mission of Twitter was getting a little bit, you know, harder to see. But what it was really good at was the news. It was really a good place you could go to find the instant news. When something like a hurricane happened, Twitter was amazing. And people would say, hey, I'm stuck on a roof, and they would get rescued. Right. If you tweeted now, I'm stuck on a roof, no one would believe you. Someone might come and beat you up. I mean, who knows what's going to happen? It's not going to be a rescue team coming to get you. So Twitter was very useful. I mean, in revolutions, Twitter was used, right? In foreign countries, you know, there were people on the streets using Twitter to gather, to get away, and things like that, which I don't think could happen today. So there were things that Twitter was very good at. It was bloated. It was, you know, moderated, I think, too much in some places. But in general, I think it was a great site. And then you get to the blue check system, which is actually a big part of the story, in that the old Twitter made some effort to vet people who had a certain amount of experience or a certain amount of celebrity or a certain amount of notoriety, so that you knew that that person was that person. Now, it was an abused system to some degree. There were people who were paying to get a blue check. It's really funny and ironic that Elon turned something that he complained people used to want to pay as much as $30,000 for a blue check. Now, nobody wants to pay $8 for a blue check. So he took something that was incredibly valuable and devalued it to the point where nobody wants it because he took away its meaning, right? The blue check used to have some level of meaning. So you went on Twitter and you're arguing and someone blue check came in and said, here's the facts. And you had some reason to believe they might know what they're talking about. Now it's a total crap, you know, fest, in that anybody who pays $8 gets one, and those tweets get moved to the top. And on the whole, those seem to be the least informational tweets. They seem to be tweets from people who know the least, because all of the celebrities and educated people and journalists and scientists got so upset that they all refused to get the blue chip or they left the site. So it really switched it around and chased away all of the vetting, and that's problematic. The site was interesting because it was anonymous to some degree, but also you had real people on it who were willing to put themselves forward. Now the real people shy away from it, and it's really problematic.
You know, when when you were telling the story in the book about the quasi-corrupt nature of the old blue check system, I remember I was at my first kind of like young DC journo, like media party. We're all like 23, 24, 2016. And everyone's like passing on, oh, I know this. It was literally like, oh, I know this one person who could like, we went to school together. They could maybe. Right. So this was the system. This was not, there was no presumption of, oh, well, if my work is meritorious enough, of course, they will grant me on a proper timeline. But I just want to say something real quick too, because this also gets at why genuinely think that someone should think about Elon also in this Zuckerbergian accidental billionaire sense. The whole, and I can't remember if you literally wrote this, but this is clearly the takeaway, is that, oh, how ironic is it that this socially awkward, not exactly the most likable person in his oldest iteration is capable of building like the ultimate social scene. Because it didn't really matter that much. But in this case, if you're talking about the blue check thing, anyone who's remotely spent any time in any place, cool, thrown a party, et cetera, would know, hey guys, just so you know, the second you charge for something of status, it's going to collapse in status, especially if the price is far too low, aka $8, $20, like whatever. This is just obvious. I mean this genuinely, because you talk about all the different lieutenants who Elon has in the room. I've had Sachs on the podcast. I've had Sriram Krishnan on the podcast. These aren't dumb people, but I'm like, guys, obviously this will collapse it in status. You don't even have to do the math here. You could sit on a whiteboard and game out that's going to happen. How did their process not catch this non-engineering problem?
Well, I mean, a couple things going on. First of all, Elon is surrounded by people who are cheerleaders, the goons, they call them at Twitter. And people don't stand up to him on things that he wants to do for the most part. But people did tell him that this was going to be a massive failure. I mean, he received notice from just about everyone in the room that this was not going to work. Yoel Roth famously gave him like a 7-page document on why the new blue check system was going to be a complete disaster. I think to some extent, there's such a cultural war going on and this anti-elitism thing going on. But also he has a personal war against journalists and journalism that seems to be going on because he was attacked for many things. And he felt strongly that the journalism as a class needed to be disbanded in favor of citizen journalism. So I think he wanted to strike out against a lot of the blue checks who had been coming up against him. There's a feeling that there's this elitist class on Twitter that was running the show that they wanted to break down and bash down. It's a populist message to get rid of the blue check system. And $8 was, a very arbitrary number. You know, originally he wanted to do $20, and then Stephen King tweeted at him, I'm not paying $20. And he said, how about $8? And suddenly it became $8. You have to remember, this is a man who's the richest man in the world. He doesn't have any real feel for what value should be.
Lucille Bluth, like, how much does a banana cost? What can it be? Like $20 thing here.
Right, exactly. I mean, he said something in the book, I remember, to somebody that, listen, everyone's got a cell phone. If you've got a cell phone, you can afford $8 a month. It's just the feeling
that... That's not how consumers make their pricing decisions.
Right, exactly. So the number came on pretty arbitrarily. But the reality is it was just kind of a foolish notion that this would somehow get rid of all the bots and no troll farm would pay $8 and somehow it would become this equitable thing. Maybe he was too optimistic. But the people around him, and part of the problem that comes out again and again in the book, is there's just no feedback loop, that nobody can go up to Elon and tell him that he's wrong without being fired. I mean, he literally fires people in the room. He calls people an idiot. He berates people. There's a scene where there's a company all hands meeting and someone starts to question his everything app, basically saying, isn't this what we have in China? And he starts screaming at the guy. I mean, in the middle of everybody. And it's he's a scary guy. He's intimidating. He's very large, intense, and he'll fire people in the room left and right. So people have to figure out how to talk to him. When you start talking and working with Elon, you're basically given a list of how to go about talking to Elon. It's tricky. So yeah, the people around him, I'm guessing people like Dave Sachs and Sriram had a feeling this was going to fail if they didn't, know outright. But it's very hard to sort of disagree with Elon and stay in that inner circle.
Yeah. And the way I just think about this, Sachs especially, was particularly aggressive on Twitter with the power to the people, populist, anti-journalism message. And the reason why, let's put aside the philosophical disagreements I may have with that statement. The reason why I was so annoyed by this, I was like, this is just the entire wrong pitch to make to not only the advertisers, but also to the broad non-subscriber base of Twitter, which is the way I think they should have done this was kind of the New York Times, Washington Post model. Basically come in and say, hey, look, Twitter is this service that, like it or love it, we all use it. It actually matters. We clearly can't base Twitter off of an advertising model. The same way that the New York Times, all these other publications, they used to be based primarily on advertising and the classified ads, but now they have subscribers. We're going to do the same model here and have this big global public where we go to. That was, I think, the successful like pitch, which whether or not that converted you know, normal people, that wouldn't have ticked off Kara Swisher, the advertisers who listen to Kara Swisher and all those different people. I just don't think they realize. I used to work at PBS. They don't know the degree to which this is all a social construction and how these different parts ping off of each other.
I mean, I think you're right in that the idea of sort of a subscription across the board, look, to because we're not going to have advertisers, we want to be able to say what we want. Let's all pay $2 and everybody's a part of Twitter or something like that might have worked. It's tricky because we've all gotten so used to everything free. I mean, the internet's all built on free that people would say, well, I'm just going to wait for a Twitter clone to come around and I'm going to go on that. But absolutely the wrong thing is to promote based on how much you pay to have a blue check system built on it. I mean, the blue check should have been something separate from whatever subscription base he felt a need to do. But, you know, it's I'm not as against advertising. I mean, I think advertising is a great way to go if it works. And Twitter was doing it well before, other than a little bit of heavy-handed moderation. I'm not of the view that Elon couldn't have just come in, cut down the moderation a little bit, and fixed the site. I don't think it was necessary to burn it to the ground. I really don't. I mean, you honestly could have revamped the moderation council, fired half the employees at the company to cut down on cost, and continued the site as it was going. And he added some good things like long form video and a potential way of editing and things like that, which seemed to work out really well, longer tweets. You could have done all that, not pissed off advertisers, not pissed off half the world, and made it a really successful site. I think more people would have used the site if you didn't chase away the journalists and didn't chase away the scientists. You're always going to have to moderate crazy. I mean, that's the other problem is you have to draw a line in the sand and say, okay, well, this is crazy. This is not, you know, or put a little note next to it saying this is crazy. I mean, you have to have some delineation of that or it turns into 4chan. But I think in general, you could have tweaked it and made it better, but that's just not how Elon works. And by burning it to the ground and scaring the advertisers away, he put himself into such a hole economically with the site that there's no choice but subscription. And there's no choice but engagement and raising the engagement because you're losing all the intellectuals. You're going to lose all the smart people. So you really got to feed your frenzy. You got to feed the people who are still on the site, which are people who like that stuff. You know, on my Twitter right now, it's a battle between people who love Elon and are going, oh, this is the best site ever. It's awesome. I can tweet what I want. And people who are like, this is the worst site I've ever been on. It's horrible. I can't tweet anything anymore because I don't want a million hate tweets coming after me. I just don't think we're in a good place right now with this site. But that's the direction he's moving it.
I guess something I'm curious about, you do not write about any of the Twitter clones at all. I had the CEO of Post News. He was the guy who made Waymo, was at Google. So I've chatted about some of the alternatives, but like, what is your take on them?
Yeah, why, on the alternative sites out there.
Why have none of them, and by the way, no offense, all of you homies building Twitter clones, but like if it was going to happen, it would have happened by now. Like that's my general take. So like what happened over the course? Because that's kind of like an adjacent story to the story you're telling.
Yeah.
You have a bunch of people, you have T2. What happened there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, everyone sees the need. It's like as soon as Elon started doing what he's doing and everything's going to, you know, in the wrong direction, and you're seeing a lot of the smart people running off of Twitter, they all want to gather somewhere. There's a lot of problems with attempting to start a clone of Twitter. And the first one of just, in general, nobody's there. And even if you get people there, you can't get them to stay because they were such habituated. Twitter is one of the best brands that was ever created, which is ironic that Elon is destroying the brand, moving to X, getting rid of the bird and all the things that work. But it's such a compelling brand. The idea of you know, MySpace disappeared because Facebook was better in some extent. It's very hard to think of something taking the space of Twitter because you need all of the people there for it to work. It's like a chicken and egg situation, which seems really, really hard to do. I think Threads had a real shot when Threads launched. You know, everyone did move over there for a brief moment in time. It just couldn't generate the excitement and the fun. It didn't start with enough. it started too fast without enough of the stuff in place to do it. It could happen, but I think people would rather just stay off until it comes back to the way it was. I mean, Twitter might actually have to die before someone, you know, starts something else that can rebuild that audience. I'm not sure it's even possible anymore, but I don't know. None of the ones have captured my attention to the point where I think it's worth even talking about yet. Everyone has a different one they want to go to, and that just doesn't really work. It has to be one place. You would think that Zuckerberg would have been able to pull it off, but okay, even he doesn't go on Threads anymore. I mean, it wasn't compelling enough. It started great. I think it started great. I think it really had a shot. And then it just sort of fizzled. And I don't know that anyone can take the place. Let's be honest. Twitter is still the absolute best place for it. I'm still on Twitter all the time. Mm. A lot of the people I used to hang out with there aren't there anymore, but I'm still there. If you have something to promote or you want to talk about something, it's still the best place to go. You're just weeding your way through a lot of garbage before you get to an actual conversation. It's more like a megaphone now where you just tweet something and then look away because you can't look anymore. It's not a place for conversation as it was, but it's still the best functioning of all the other things, which isn't to say very much. It's like you're on an airplane that's the worst flight of your life, but it's the only plane that goes to your destination. I mean, you're still going to complain about it and say how awful this was, and I wish we were back on a nice plane. But, you know, that's the only plane we've got right now.
And I think that takeaway from Threads, I'm proud. The first and only thread I ever put out was, I'm getting serious Google Plus here. Google Plus vibes here, guys. So that is going to, if you go to my threads, that will be there and will be the take, which I think is going to age well. But I mean, the other problem is just that Twitter's also hard. If we actually think about different social media functions, like writing, being quippy, being succinct, sometimes longer, it's actually like very, like versus like even TikTok, like everyone goes viral on TikTok once. That's like the whole thing. Right. Even Instagram, just share the photos from your wedding. I just did that. I just think that the like of all the forms of social media, tweeting, the written, the short form, even in a weird way, blogging is kind of easier even for a normal person. That's just like journaling. Just like spew your thoughts into your journal and then it's just on your live journal like it's 2003. Twitter's hard. And I think it's so hard that unless you get that, like, you know, top 5% who contribute, like it's more than the 80-20 rule, almost certainly. Like that real 5% that's building most of the content and the engagement, it's just not going to work.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's very tricky, and it used to be even trickier because you were limited in format even more to the characters. To tweet something that resonates and rises up is an incredible skill set. You know, there are certain people on there who are very good at Twitter, which was really amazing, but now it's gone now. I mean, it really, the tweets that rise to are just the worst for the most part. There's still a little bit here and there, but in general, the engine has changed to what becomes a good tweet and what doesn't. But yeah, it's not as easy. It's not as personal. It's not about your friends. It's really the world at large. And that was what was cool about it, and hopefully could be cool again. But it trying to be this global town hall where everyone says something and some of the things are smart enough that go flying. It's a wonderful thing, and it's going to be hard for someone to sort of make one again.
So for the last two or three questions here, something you did, which I thought was, once again, an effective use of your narrative style of writing, was you pointed out that it was the wrong decision to limit the Hunter Biden New York Post story on a couple of different levels. But you also, though, successfully put us in the mind of the staff at Twitter who made the decision. I'm always pushing this for people to understand. It's like, you guys have to understand that on Facebook in 2016, a variety of groups and individuals did promote actual Russian election interference propaganda. That didn't change the result of the election, but it actually happened. And that happening dominated the next 6 years of American politics. Everyone's getting hauled into Congress. Everyone's doing this, this, and that. So if you go back and talk to the PMs at Facebook and say, hey, if you could snap your fingers and just like delete that like Blacks for Trump group in Wisconsin that's run by the GRU, they would all do it. So that is what someone is thinking as it's going down in 2020. So I think what we need to have moving forward isn't this like, oh, look at these censorious idiots who made the wrong call. They need an actual mental framework for shifting through this, because it can't be either I shut this down or my boss gets hauled before Congress and I get fired. We actually need an actionable framework. So like, do you maybe you don't
I mean, 100%. I think people forget what was going on when they moderated the tweet. I mean, you're sitting in a room and the FBI has just put out this thing saying, watch out for Russian disinformation. This isn't a big election. There's going to be attempts. Maybe they're going to use Hunter Biden. I mean, they literally laid out what might happen. And suddenly you get this Post article, which, you know, the laptop, if you remember, was found in a computer store by this person. I don't want to say anything, but anyways, you can read the story, who then hands it to Rudy Giuliani, right?
It's the fakest real story of all time. Right. My reaction, it's the fakest real story of all time.
And it's got these crazy stories about Hunter Biden and Uncle Joe and all this kind of stuff. And you're like, I mean, it sounds pretty fake to me. and I don't know. And if I put it up and I allow it to go viral and it affects the election, am I pushing forward something that seems wrong and seems wrong? Or do I wait a couple days? Do I suspend it, moderate for a couple days and see where this goes? And you can see, you know, it becomes political, obviously. It becomes, if you're going to believe everything Rudy Giuliani says, you're going to throw it forward. If you're someone who sees that he might be crazy, you're not going to put it forward. They tried to make the right decision. And they all really, it's a nuanced thing. It wasn't like, oh, yes, no. I mean, they debated it. They went back and forth. Jack disagreed with it. Even Yoel Roth disagreed with it. Nobody wanted to moderate it, but they were in a difficult place making a difficult decision. I mean, you could say, let's just throw out all the decision-making, just put everything up there. But that's, in my opinion, I would argue a worse site. You can't just throw everything up there if you're trying to find truth. If you just want to entertain people, sure, go ahead, throw everything up there. And it becomes, you know, a site full of that, which is where we are now. But I do think they tried to make the right decisions. And it was a really crazy thing. And so, you know, in the end, I think they probably made the wrong decision. I don't know what I would have done in that situation, but I think it was wrong to sort of, you know, moderate something like the New York Post for putting an article out. You could have done it in a different way. You could have said, you know, this is a New York Post article, read it for what it is. But it went the way it went. So yes, I don't think it's as simple as that. It's not simple. I mean, it's just not simple.
I think the best policy is, with all things 2020, I think we give everyone just an amnesty pass and then say, how do we prevent X, Y, and Z from happening moving forward? Because I think it's just impossible to, as we get further and further away from that period, it's harder and harder to just put ourselves in the mindset of like, man, because once again, and here's the thing too, if you're that Twitter moderator, don't forget, like, there's this whole, especially on the center left, like, reckoning over, did James Comey throw the election to Trump weeks before in 20? So you are a random Twitter PM thinking about these things. And I think the broader point is just that the actual Jack Dorsey systems level structure of Twitter wasn't up to that level of stress. It should not have been on these people to make this call. And the fact that Jack wasn't there as it's happening, this was not the time for a Fiji Javan vacation, is the actual point. Okay, so let's close here. So we've been tough but fair towards Elon. Here's where I think I'm the most bullish on Elon in general. One could listen to this episode or read your book, you know, the subtitle is the, you know, most controversial takeover in corporate history, and just say like, okay, this is going to just be this like hubristic, he finally reached too far, he's Alexander the Great going into India, why did you do it, Alexander, turn back. You could tell that version of the story, but the reality is, I think the assessment of whether or not the various gambles and moves Elon made, whether they were the right ones, is really about the timeline you're operating under. So if we're looking at the past year, I think it looks terrible. However, I think if we look at Tesla in 2008, ooh, that's a failure. If we look at, you know, SpaceX in 2007, that's a failure. Elon's ability is, he's directionally correct. So on a long enough timeline, you could critique a failed launch or the Roadster not selling well, but he's going to be right. So what timeline?
Well, that's asking
you to make a prediction. How should we get the timeline?
Yeah, I'd argue that this breaks the whole mold, because not only is it about Twitter, but it's about Elon. And I don't think the world will look at Elon the same ever again. I do think that, I personally think Twitter is a disaster, and that the only way for it to work is for him to go away from it, or to let it go on its own and no longer be running the site, to really let Linda take over the site, which I don't think is going to happen, and to step back into Tesla and SpaceX, into the world that he is great at. I think the real problem is that Elon has done himself massive damage by showing himself to half the world as being someone that can't be taken seriously, or at least has to be seen as potentially dangerous in the way he's running this company. And I think that the way I look at it now is, so Walter Isaacson, who's the biographer of our times, wrote the great Elon biography. I don't think he would have done it today. I think he did it over a year ago because at that point in time, Elon was widely seen as Edison or Einstein. But today, Elon is not seen that way. And I think Walter would not have walked in to write that biography today because Elon is not the same Elon he was a year ago. And, you know, if you read the Walter biography, it's very similar to what you just said, which is like, there's Tesla, there's SpaceX. They started as failures, but now they're brilliant successes. Okay, Twitter's looking really bad, but he'll come through in the end. Our plucky hero will win in the end, because he's shoehorning what's happening this year into a wider story, trying to make Elon be the Elon he was a year ago. But that's not the Elon of today. The Elon of today is the guy who retweeted the Paul Pelosi conspiracy theory about, you know, this poor
great
old
chapter,
man.
By the way, that's very, very, I love your writing.
And it's
there.
Intense.
Great chapter.
That's the Elon we're all going to see from now on. And even if somehow Twitter survives in some form of the dirty circus chat room of a bank application, which is what it looks like it's going to become, it doesn't mean he succeeded. It means he did massive damage to himself and his reputation. He showed who he maybe really is deep down. And then he still succeeded in the other companies that we love him for. I just think it's not just a mistake. I think it is something that he needs to overcome to rewrite history. So yeah, 100 years from now and we go to Mars, people can be like, oh, look, Elon got us to Mars. And then he did something at Twitter. But the Elon of our lifespan has changed pretty dramatically because of all this. And he needs to resuscitate and go back to the way he was.
Yeah. And the closing thing, because this is what I really appreciate what you just said. The problems that Elon's solving in versions 1 and 2, SpaceX, Tesla, are engineering challenges. They're challenges where we could put aside the hustle porn critique, where you actually can just be on the factory floor or fly out to the Pacific for 3 months straight and just sacrifice everything physically, mentally, et cetera, to solve it. No one on left, right, or center is arguing that the problems facing Twitter are ones that are solved by just spending some late nights in San Francisco coding until your fingers bleed. Like, these are not engineering challenges.
Absolutely
these are
not.
Sociocultural business challenges. And reading your book, it's unclear if Elon is up to solving challenges in that category.
Yeah, I don't think he is. But I mean, we'll see what happens. But I honestly think his best move at this point would be to walk away from it. And we'll see if he's capable of doing that.
And I think what he'll end up doing, just I guess to your point, is what he would basically do is over leverage the story of Twitter was going to die.
Right, right.
Before
that's
I came
the story
in.
You're trying to tell.
I stabilized it, but I need to go back to going to the moon and like
right,
building
right.
our, you know,
yeah,
like,
and let other think people handle it. And hopefully yeah. It'll roll back all the things that he did and bring it back to the Twitter it was. But we'll see. But yeah.
That is an excellent place to leave it. Ben, always a pleasure. And by the way, I just saw the news today. This is going to be turned into a movie.
TV show. We're actually doing a limited series. A limited series sold to MGM. We're developing it. We're out finding our Elon now. So hopefully we'll find the right actor. The great thing about this story is you could really fill multiple seasons. So we'll see. We'll see what direction it goes. But yes, you'll be able to see it on the screen hopefully pretty soon.
Can I just ask you a personal question then?
Sure.
Which feels cooler, right? Because think about the eras we're living in. So like if it's 2009 and I'm like, oh, hey, like I love The Accidental Billionaires. You're like, yeah, it's going to be a TV show. I'm like, oh, cool.
Yeah, it's a different world, right?
I'm like, oh, like they're doing the Hallmark version. But now
I have to say, you know, my career is interesting in that I'm pretty old school and that all of my books that have been the screen have pretty much been movies. I mean, The Social Network, 21, and now Dumb Money, which is still trickling into theaters. I usually go for the big movie. In this case, you know, we had choices and for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's not the big biopic. You know, Elon, the Isaacson story is the big biopic and feels like, okay, that's a movie. I'm trying to tell this sort of dramatic thrill ride, you know, when he walks in the doors of Twitter and it all takes place in those 6 weeks where he's running through Twitter. And it just, what's going on in television today is so amazing at telling this sort of story. The quality of these limited series are just so phenomenal. It's like a 9-hour movie that you can watch at home. I don't know. I haven't really had one yet. So it felt like this is sort of the right moment for me to attempt to do that. I do have a project that's coming to TV on Netflix next year, I think, about my Russia book, Once Upon a Time in Russia, is going to be made by Netflix. And I've written for Billions, you know, for a while and stuff like that. So I've done some TV, but this feels like my move into sort of that sort of thing. And we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I love movies. I love going to movie theaters. But there are certain projects that feel like they're made more for this sort of thing. So we'll see.
Yeah. No, and
but it is a different era. I mean, I would say that back when I wrote, you know, in the Social Network, and someone had said, "Oh, you're going to be on TV," and you're like, "Okay." Like, that means instead of like the, you know, Ben Affleck, we're going to get the cast of Saved by the Bell. But nowadays, you get real. I mean, the big actors all do television, so there's no more that stigma to TV that there was when we were growing up, which is a good thing.
Yeah. Well, best of luck casting. He's got a unique. Yeah, that's we can't just like, you know, cake Jared Leto. We can't just have Jared Leto pack on some pounds.
Are certain actors you need to be big, you need to be intimidating, you need to be mercurial and funny.
But also smart, right? It's hard. It's a combination.
It's a hard role, but someone's really going to do a great job with it. And I think what's going to be neat is you'll probably have a TV Elon and a movie Elon. So we're going to probably have two Elons, and we'll see which direction each of us go. But it's going to be cool. I can't wait for this to get off the ground.
Awesome. Well, best of luck, Ben. This is all really great.
Thank you very much.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.